to Never Give Up, a free event of readings about Portland civil rights hero Minoru Yasui. And that's tomorrow night, Wednesday, July 29th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Jade Apano Multicultural Space at 8114 Southeast Division Street in Portland. And you can find out more at theaterdiaspora.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you, fabulous Janet Anderson, our engineer. And visit stageandstudio.org and like me on facebook.com/stage, the letter and studio. Till next time, I'm Dimay Roberts.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. This family-friendly event will include barbecue grub, live music and a DJ, activities for kids, family swim in the pool, local vendors, and more. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. at Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Revival Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Willamette River Revival is a community-based river festival to celebrate and reconnect with the lower Willamette River and its cleanup. The Grand Ronde Tribe will host a salmon bake. There will also be tabling by environmental groups, Native American crafts, live folk music, storytelling, and other activities. Again, that's the Willamette River Revival, Sunday, August 2nd, from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
So have a go. I'd like to be a gallery. Put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. And he's here to talk about Gods and Heroes, masterpieces from the École des Beaux-Arts Paris. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Dawson.
Always a pleasure, Joseph.
This show is one of these special exhibitions, and every room is full of these extraordinary narrative paintings, very classical in style. Just to tell us, what is the École des Beaux-Arts?
Well, the École is by far the most important and influential art school in the Western world. Its methods determined the way that art was taught not only in France, but across Europe and America as well. The story of the École really begins in 1648, when a group of 12 artists petitioned the then young King Louis XIV to found a Royal Academy of Painting and Sculpture. And he does it. The school begins as the school of the academy. One of the academy's most essential functions was to teach young artists. The crown, bestowing its royal patronage of this organization, sought to control the way that art was produced as well, because it was all about glorifying the king at that moment. History buffs will be delighted with this exhibition because it covers this period from the absolute monarchy of Louis XIV through the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, the establishment of the Republic, the coming of Napoleon and his empire, and the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty. Throughout this tumultuous period in French history, the École thrived and changed. The image of art, the function of art, changed over this time. And this is part of the story of the exhibition.
when you come in, the first thing you see is a picture of Louis the 14th, a portrait, and then say you turn to the right, there's a painting, Jean-Baptiste Cournet. It's Hercules killing Busiris, king of Egypt, who sacrificed foreigners to Jupiter. So 1675, people painted Hercules, and the idea was France was Hercules, or the king was Hercules.
It was really that the king was Hercules, and he was not the only European monarch to identify with the great hero of classical mythology. And in this case, it's Hercules bringing justice to this unjust ruler. And so Louis, as the promoter of justice within his realm.
Part of the patronage thing was, you know, you had to paint things that were flattering to the monarchy.
Yes, indeed.
But, you know, that's only a very small part of what an artist thrives on. What were they learning? You know, who were they inspired by at this period, the late 17th century?
Well, one thing that has to be understood about the École and the Academy is that they had a rigid hierarchy of genres. And at the top was history painting, depictions of subjects from the Bible, classical mythology and history, noble, edifying subjects. And beneath that was portraiture, followed by genre painting, paintings of everyday life, landscape, and still life at the bottom, because the last two don't involve the human figure. This was a school that was really about communication with the figure, about good storytelling, telling stories in still images that would move in the way that the writers of those tales originally moved with their words.
Mm-hmm. So many of the paintings are, you've got multiple people sort of almost falling over each other. There's so much activity going on. Bodies bent and twisted and, you know, naked or draped. There's such an incredible focus on the body. Did they go there? What was the first thing they learned?
All of the attention of the École focused on expression with the human figure, and particularly the male human figure. That was because God made man in his own image. It was considered the ideal form. And, of course, it was the way that this art touches us. It touches us with very human things. And so the students were taught to examine body language and facial expressions. They were encouraged in this in a series of competitions held throughout the year. They didn't really have a grading system as we know, but rather the system of competitions that tested the students' ability to draw and to paint the figure.
A lot of the pieces, as you walk around, you know, you're going to see sketches, such as Alexandra Hess. There's a peasant woman seen in profile, holding in her arms a child. Sorry.
This was a drawing that Hess made for a large-scale painting he executed of St. Francis de Sales preaching to the peasants, that is in the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris. And it illustrates in the context of the drawings that are shown in that room that the practice of drawing did not stop as students left the École. It was something that they used throughout their careers. It was absolutely the fundamental of all art production.
So they were drawing from casts a lot of the time, is that right?
In one room, the first room that drawing is considered, we have in the middle of the room a volume of Diderot's Encyclopedia, opened to an illustration for the entry on drawing, and it shows the process by which students learn to draw. The very youngest students were charged with copying the drawings of their teachers. In other words, they learned to copy flat art first. Mm-hmm. And when that was mastered, they were then moved along to drawing from plaster casts of famous ancient statues. And only when that was mastered were they allowed to begin to draw from the life model.
Mm-hmm. That isn't that how the Portland Art Museum began, right? So
indeed. Well, it began with a collection of plaster casts.
Is that common throughout the world?
Absolutely. It became very common, a common way to utilize these very great images from the ancient world for the Academy and for the École. The example of ancient works of art, ancient Greek and Roman works of art, was absolutely paramount. And they saw themselves as the heir to this great tradition.
Mm-hmm. There is a great image of a hall with a glass roof and all these winged horses and headless people lined up on plinths. So that would be a working studio, you'd walk amongst them drawing?
Absolutely, and they did. The plaster cast collection is no longer there. It was somewhat badly damaged during the student riots in 1968, at which point they moved it out to Versailles. And now that great open courtyard at the École, well, it's a way they make money. They rent it out and make money with it. No greater moment for which is Paris Fashion Week. The couturiers vie to get their shows into the École des Beaux-Arts. It's such a beautiful space. But the collection of plaster casts was vast. The artists, of course, also had the collection of the Louvre once it was established at the end of the 18th century, just across the river.
There's one section where it's just torsos. These are oil paintings, men with gray abs, yeah, sort of draped, with red cloth covering their legs. So you're just focusing on the torso, and there's got to be a dozen of these. Now, what are these? Are they studies?
They are indeed. They were painted for the annual torso competition that depicts the half-length figure posed in an elaborate fashion. And the purpose was to exercise a student's knowledge of the figure, its anatomical structure, but most particularly, it challenged the student to portray the figure in a palpable three-dimensional fashion, ranging from highlight into deep shadow, so that they were challenged to show with equal clarity those parts that were in shadow.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. He's talking about gods and heroes, masterpieces from the École des Beaux-Arts Paris. This incredible show starts upstairs. You go through the torso area, then you come down the stairs into a wonderful room where it's just a room full of gorgeous oil paintings, and they're all kind of the same size.
They are all the same size.
They're all addressing mythology or historical events.
Subjects from the Bible.
Emperors, yeah, Jesus. It's so regular. You just get the feeling that this school had a real mission.
Well, it did indeed. And that mission was aimed at just this kind of history painting. And that room treats the greatest of the annual competitions. It was known as the Prix de Rome because the winner got a 5-year scholarship to study at the French Academy in Rome to complete his education.
Mm-hmm. So you'd get 5 years room and board living in Rome just studying art.
Yes, and one had to perform during that period. The educational part didn't cease. One wasn't free just to roam the streets of Rome, so to speak. There were exercises and the like, but it took the students from Paris to the center of the ancient Roman world and challenged them to learn from the art that was there.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a great comparison. It's two artists who do the same subject, and the title is
Queen Zenobia.
Queen Zenobia was pregnant. Her husband was worried she was going to be caught by bandits.
Her husband was the king of Armenia. He was conquered, and he was worried that the conquering forces would capture her and torture her, and so he stabs his pregnant wife. Thinking that she's dead, he tosses her into the river, and her body is recovered, and she survives. And the scene shows her being rescued by a group of peasants. These two paintings were made for the competition in 1850. And in that room of the Prix de Rome paintings, we've hung them in chronological order from 1721 around to 1850. And the reason we show two from 1850 is that both the winner that year, Paul Baudry, and the runner-up, Bouguereau, were both allowed to go to Rome. In this case, it was because Bouguereau had won the competition, had come in second 2 years before, but the winner that year had never claimed the prize, and so he was allowed to go to Rome along with Baudry as well. He was a magnificent student. Standing before these two paintings, one can see why Baudry edged Bouguereau out. There's just a slightly higher quality, a slightly higher dramatic value. But in that little section, we show a bit about the competition itself. It began when the subject for the year was announced to the students. And at the end of that day, by the end of that day, the students had to produce an oil sketch that would define the composition. And they had to stick very closely to that oil sketch or risk elimination mm-hmm. from the contest.
The oil sketch was a, what, 12 by 12?
Not even, even smaller. A small painted sketch. Painted sketches could have been easily altered after that first day by the students. And so on that wall, we also show how they prevented cheating. They did it by doing a tracing, a very accurate tracing of the composition at the end of that first day so that the students couldn't alter the sketch over the next 72 days that they had to produce the finished painting.
They had like one day of inspiration and design.
That's right.
And then they had 70 days of execution.
Exactly. And so it really favored the artists who could very quickly compose a brilliant composition and see it through. Mm-hmm. They could change little details, but not the overall compositional structure.
Mm-hmm. What period in school career are they hitting the Prix de Rome?
They're hitting it about age 20 or in their early 20s. And one of the things that visitors so far have remarked at repeatedly is how high the level of quality is of these extraordinary things done by very young artists. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're talking about, in most cases, artists who go on to very great careers. One of the best things in that room is Fragonard's painting. And at age 20, Fragonard is essentially as good as he ever is. He's just already an extraordinary artist.
What's that called?
It is a scene that shows Jeroboam sacrificing to idols and a prophet crying to God to wither his hand, which is in the process of being withered. It's a very dramatic scene.
Is that the one with the golden calf?
Yes, exactly.
As you move on from those Prix de Rome pieces, the next room is all about landscape. And there was another competition.
Yes, indeed. Landscape was near the bottom of the hierarchy of genres, but attitudes toward it began to change in the early 19th century, and a competition was instituted that devoted to landscape. It was a change in attitudes, but the competition was really mainly instituted in response to the arrival of an extraordinary student, a student who was able to synthesize the great ideal landscapes of Italy with the realism, the naturalism in Dutch art. His name was Achille Michelon. He would be one of the great famous names in the history of landscape painting today. Very shortly after he arrived back in Paris from his 5 years in Rome, he died. Also in that room is an area devoted to life at the Villa Medici, the French Academy in Rome, that shows that architects were also involved. There's a portrait by Bouguereau of his fellow student, the architect Charles Garnier. Your listeners will know Garnier because he was the architect of one of the great Beaux-Arts buildings, the Paris Opera. And some of his drawings made of ancient architecture are included in the exhibition.
The exhibition really culminates with Jacques-Louis David. There's a sort of corridor you lead up to his great painting, Andromache Mourning Hector. Who is David and why does he get sort of prime position?
David is one of the giants of French art. He's the artist who essentially codified the neoclassical style and was vastly influential with it. He went on to become one of the great teachers at the Ecole, a very tyrannical teacher, it must be said. Andromache Mourning Hector is one of his very greatest neoclassical paintings.
This is a woman sitting by a bed. Hector's on the bed, presumably dead. There's a little boy on her lap.
Their son. Hector has been killed by Achilles. His body dragged around the walls of Troy in great disrespect. But the gods do protect that body ultimately, and it is returned to the Trojan royal family. He's lying on his bier. Andromache is mourning him, looking upward and in tears, and her grief is palpable. Their young son is reaching up to her to comfort her and seeking comfort as well. And the composition is arranged in plane, stepping back from the picture plane itself, rigidly hierarchical, but extremely deeply felt. On the candelabrum that is depicted behind, David included the words of Homer describing this moment. It's a real competition here. David is pitting himself to create an image that will be as affecting as Homer's words, and indeed he achieves that. It's a great monument of neoclassicism. It was David's reception piece into the Royal Academy. This is once he's become a mature artist to gain full membership. Every member had to give the Academy a grand example of their art, and this is it. And beside it is David's pre-de-Rome winning painting, the painting that got him that 5-year scholarship to Rome when he was a student at the Ecole, painted 9 years before. It's like a different artist. It's a much more immature artist. It's an artist who looks more like Fragonard than David. The juxtaposition illustrates that the process, the methods of the Ecole ultimately did work. The goal was to make great artists, and indeed in David's case, that is exactly what happened.
So the earlier painting is his Erasistratus discovers the cause of Antiochus's disease.
Yes, Antiochus and Strata Nietzsche. Antiochus was a prince, and he falls in love with his father's second wife, his young wife, Strata Nietzsche. He can't tell anyone. He begins to refuse food, drink, and begins to wither away. And the doctor finally realizes the reason behind his demise. And the father grants his young wife to his son.
Mm-hmm. This is another bed scene. I'm lying on a bed surrounded by people, a young woman. Must be the young bride, and the father hand, sort of handing her over or waving her forward. Between the two, what happened in 9 years?
Well, he goes off to Rome. He experiences the ancient art of Rome, ancient relief sculpture, real examples, not just plaster casts of ancient sculpture. His style evolves, becomes more concentrated and far more profound. The Andromache Mourning Hector is one of the great tragic images in all of art.
The school carried on 20th century.
It didn't really lose its influence until after the First World War. Although by the middle of the 19th century, its methods were viewed by many artists as being too restrictive. They were beginning to turn away from it. Many artists would attend the Ecole to learn to draw, but then leave it behind, not worry about the competitions. One also finds that in some cases, the Ecole got it wrong. The great sculptor Rodin was 3 times denied admission to the Ecole. His manner was so out of keeping with academic manners. Of course, the Impressionists come along and art begins to change. Mm-hmm. And be much more about an avant-garde. The importance of the Ecole, really, was that it established this method of treating narrative paintings. And these were just vastly influential. In the works of some filmmakers today, you can still see the influence of this kind of compositional technique.
It was a school always associated with an academy, and when the idea of academic became distasteful and uncool, the school began to sort of wither away?
Yes. One has to remember, though, that this kind of painting was, until late in the 19th century, deemed the highest point of art. And our attitudes toward very great artists like Chardin in the 18th century, Watteau, and the like, this wasn't the kind of art that at the time would have been viewed at the pinnacle. It was the art of the Ecole, as conservative as it became. One thing that the Prix de Rome room illustrates, because it runs from 1721 to 1850, is it's a little mini history of art in France. And one does see style somewhat evolve. But one of the things that the room teaches is that the paintings do also have a very similar look. Naturally, they reflect the teachings of the Academy and the Ecole. And in time, artists began to see this as restrictive, quite naturally.
And I was amazed when you told me there were a lot of foreign students at the school.
Yes, indeed.
Where did a lot of them come from?
Well, by far, the majority of them came from our shores. They were Americans who went to study there. And one thing that we haven't mentioned that's crucial here is that women were excluded from the Ecole until 1897. They were occasionally admitted to the academy itself, really exceptional artists like Elizabeth Vigée Lebrun. But this was very, very rare. Women artists had to learn outside of the Ecole. Many of them studied with the Ecole's professors in their private studios, but they could not attend classes at the Ecole.
It was very much a place, so you learned to draw there, but to learn to paint, you went somewhere else.
Yes, you went to the professor's personal studios outside the Ecole to learn to paint as well as to create works of sculpture. Then, in 1863, the curriculum is reformed and the studios are moved into the Ecole itself. So painting and sculpture and printmaking were taught within the Ecole as well as drawing.
Mm-hmm. It is an amazing exhibition. Who brought it here? How did it get here?
The exhibition was created by the curator at the Ecole des Beaux-Arts, Emmanuel Schwartz, and the American Federation of Arts. The American Federation of Arts is by far the most venerable exhibition organizer in the U.S. It was founded in 1909. It's created over 3,000 exhibitions in its history to bring great works of art to places in America that normally do not have a chance to see these things.
Mm-hmm. You've also marked paintings elsewhere in the museum, which are influenced by the school?
We've gone through the European and American collections at the Portland Art Museum, and we've added subsidiary labels that indicate all the students at the Ecole des Beaux-Arts. Visitors will be able to leave the exhibition and wander into the permanent collection galleries and see the influence of this great Ecole on the history of European and American art.
It's a great show. It makes you want to go to Paris.
Indeed.
At least we're lucky enough that it came here. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Dawson Carr. He's the Janet and Richard Geary Curator of European Art at the Portland Art Museum. Talking about gods and heroes, masterpieces from the Ecole des Beaux-Arts, Paris. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO, Dawson.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympia. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Aurora Colony Vineyards 2015 Jazz Festival, August 9th, with doors opening at 2 p.m. and performances from 3 to 9 p.m. The Aurora Colony Vineyards is located at 21338 Oak Lane Northeast in Aurora, Oregon. Performers include Tony Lincoln, the Ron Steen Band, Picante Latin Jazz, Tom Grant, and many more. Again, that's the Aurora Colony Vineyards Jazz Festival, August 9th, from 2 to 9 p.m. More information about directions and ticket prices can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Summer Concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of Summer Concerts in the Park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the Summer Concert in Dawson Park with Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North